We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In December of 1890, American troops killed almost 300 Lakota Sioux men, women, and children near Wounded Knee Creek in South Dakota. It was one of the great tragedies of American history. Why did it happen? This morning in this hour of Focus, we're talking with historian Heather Cox Richardson. She's the author of a newly published book. The title is Wounded Knee, Party Politics and the Road to an American Massacre. Basic Books is the publisher. She argues in this book that the disaster that was Wounded Knee grew out of a set of political forces that certainly are familiar to us still today. Fierce partisanship, some heated political rhetoric, and a profit-driven media. We'll talk about Wounded Knee and how the stage, perhaps, was set for this, not so much in South Dakota, but a long way away in Washington, D.C. And, of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome, too. Ask people to be brief so that we can keep moving along, but questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. And then we do have email. You can send along your question that way. Send it to will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, you're certainly welcome to call. Our guest, Heather Cox Richardson, is professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She's also authors of the book West from Appomattox and The Death of Reconstruction. And she's joining us this morning by telephone. Professor Richardson, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me, David.
Well, thank you very much for being with us. You know, I understand that, in fact, the impetus for the research here that led to the book came from a question that was asked by a student in one of your classes.
In fact, that's the case. Somebody asked me to explain Wounded Knee because I had just written a book talking about how fierce the Sioux fought the American Army and how they had been so successful. And they said, I was teaching the 1890s, and they said, well, then why did they lose to the Army? Mm. And it looked to me like I didn't have a good answer. So I started to look around and discovered the story was very, very different than anybody had told before.
Yeah. It's complicated, but I guess I think that part of the setup or the way to start maybe was to talk a little bit about what was happening at the time in national politics in Washington, where the president was a Republican, the Congress was held by Republicans, and they were coming up to, there were going to be midterm elections in 1890 in this year. The Republicans wanted to hang on to the White House and the Congress, and they apparently thought that the key to their electoral success lie in the West.
Indeed they did, and that's really the crux of the book and of the question to me. We look at the massacre, and most people have heard of the massacre, but nobody had ever asked the question of why did one-third of the U.S. Army, 9,000 men, go into South Dakota in November of 1890. Nobody had ever asked why they were sent in, and the question for that lay back in the East over control over the national government. In 1890, America was divided very bitterly between the very wealthy, the people that we know as robber barons, the people who built the Newport mansions and ate their dinner on gold plates, and the people who were working in the factories, children, men, women working for pennies to do really horrific work. And the country was bitterly divided between the very wealthy and the very poor, between Republicans and Democrats, and between the East and the West. And for the Republicans, they had a real problem in 1890 and a real problem in 1892, and that is that Benjamin Harrison, who was president, elected in 1888, was only one of now three American presidents who was elected with a minority of the popular vote. He had about 100,000 fewer votes than Grover Cleveland. So he knew going into the 1890 and then the 1892 elections that the Republicans had to strengthen their hand or they would not win. And in order to do that, they did a number of things that eventually led to what happened in South Dakota in December of that year.
Mm-hmm. And just to round out the story here, the Republicans certainly had good reason to be concerned because, in fact, they lost in that midterm election. The Democrats took control of Congress, and then in 1892, Benjamin Harrison lost his reelection bid.
That's correct, to Grover Cleveland. Mm. Yes, they had very good reason to be worried because not only did they lose, it was a very dramatic loss. In the summer of 1890, really everything that could go wrong for the Republicans went wrong that year. There was a terrible drought across the West, and one of the things that that did was it inspired the populists and the Democrats. And most people have heard about the populists, but never really in a larger context. And what happened in the summer of 1890 is they managed to bleed a great deal of voters away from the Republicans. So after the election of 1890, the midterm election of 1890, the Republicans discovered that they had lost the House by a margin of 2-1. This is a huge loss. And that they had kept the Senate by only 4 votes. The problem was that 3 of those Republican voters in the Senate, in fact, had begun to vote against the Republican program. So they really could only hold the Senate by 1 vote after the midterm election of 1890, and they held it by that 1 seat in South Dakota. Unfortunately for them, that seat in South Dakota had been up for election, and the election had been tampered with. What that meant was that South Dakota was going to have to figure out whether they were going to put a Democrat or a Republican into that Senate seat. And as we know, in the 19th century, senators were chosen by the legislature, not by direct voting, which meant that the legislature was going to have to meet, and there was going to be a long, drawn-out struggle over whether that Senate seat from South Dakota was going to be a Republican seat and protect the president and his legislation, or whether it was going to be a Democratic seat and destroy all the legislation that Harrison and his men had passed in the past 2 years. So South Dakota becomes the hinge for the entire country from 1890, in a period when the country, as I say, is completely divided between the Republicans and the Democrats, pro-business versus pro-regulation forces, and the East and the West.
Very quickly, just let me introduce again our guest, Heather Cox Richardson. She's professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She is a scholar of American political history. Her most recent book is Wounded Knee, Party Politics and the Road to an American Massacre. It's published by Basic Books and tries to look at what was going on in national politics at the time in America and how those forces really contributed to making the massacre happen, setting up the circumstances that led to that massacre there in South Dakota. That happened in the winter of 1890. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, let's talk some more about South Dakota, and particularly now here, the Republicans in Washington, they wanted to maintain their hold on the Congress and the White House. They, as we said, they believed that the West was a key and that South Dakota was particularly important. And they seemed to think that there were a lot of people there in South Dakota that either had voted Republican or would likely vote Republican or certainly want to maintain them as Republicans. So what in Washington, what were they doing for the people who lived in the West to try to secure their support?
Well, this is actually a great question if you think about it. And you step if you step back for a minute, the Republicans want to hold the White House not because, you know, they feel like it's a nice place to live, but because in the 1890s, Republicans really believed that if they lost control over the government, that socialists were going to take over. They believed the Democratic Party was socialist, that socialists would take over, and that they would destroy America. So they really believed that it was them or the deluge, if you will, that they had to stay in power or America was going to be destroyed. So it's not just sort of a little bit of jockeying that no one cares about. They really think it's a life and death issue. What that means is once Harrison goes into power, knowing that he goes into power with less than a majority of the American people behind him, what that means is they owe a duty to the country to do everything they possibly can to make sure the Republicans never lose to the Democrats. They really see it as their fundamental duty, and they don't hide this. It's not like this is some conspiracy. They trumpet it. They actually buy a major newspaper, and it becomes Harrison's organ, and he says again and again, this is what we're going to do, and this is why. Well, one of the first things they do is they try and add new states to the Union, new states that they believe will vote Republican, and in fact, they do. In 1889, the Republicans under Harrison add 4 new states to America. They had South Dakota, North Dakota, and Montana, and then Washington. The next year, they're going to add two more, Idaho and Wyoming. But they add these new states, these four new states in 1889, believing that what will happen is that these states, if they come in under a Republican administration, will vote Republican. They firmly believe that's going to happen. And, in fact, that is what happens, except Montana. And in Montana, the Harris administration throws out the ballots and, in fact, installs Republicans instead of the Democrats who were there. So they get Republican voters in the West. But more importantly than just having states that are generally Republican, more importantly, what that means is four new Republican senators. And it also changes the Electoral College, because the Electoral College is apportioned according to how many senators and representatives each state has. That's going to give the Republicans for each one of those states three more members in the Electoral College. And they believe, and they say very clearly, that they believe this is going to make sure that a Democrat cannot win the White House for a very, very long time. So they start by doing that, but there's a little teeny problem in that. South Dakota is over half Sioux land. So they have to be able to take Sioux land in order to make a state out of South Dakota. Mind you, they're going to do it anyway, but they don't actually have the land to do it. So in 1889, the Harris administration puts an enormous amount of pressure on the Sioux to agree to give up more than half of their land in the what was known as the Great Sioux Reservation, which was essentially the western half of South Dakota, to break that up into six smaller reservations. If they do that, they're supposed to get a number of things, most especially money and food, and then a lot of other things as well. And the Sioux agree to it on a number of very important conditions. When this treaty goes back east, in fact, Congress ignores the conditions, and Harrison opens the Great Sioux Reservation, that is most of South Dakota, to settlers without ever providing the Indians anything that they're supposed to be provided. So they've lost more than half their land without really getting anything in return. What that means is, with the drought I mentioned in South Dakota and the lack of their land, now they can't feed themselves. So there's a real problem and a growing problem on the reservations. And when that happens, the Indians then turn to a religious movement that promises to bring back food and a world before all the settlers came. This, you can see tension starting to build in South Dakota between the Indians and the government, but it is a nonviolent movement, a nonviolent religious movement, and the real problem is that the Sioux are starving. What happens then is, when it becomes clear in 1890 that the populist movement is taking a lot of voters away from the Republican Party, what happens then is that the Harris administration puts enormous pressure on the reservations by removing the Indian agents who had been working with the Sioux there and replacing them with Republican political appointees who can distribute contracts to important people in the state who will then hire voters who will vote Republican. And when that happens, the whole scene is set for what's going to happen in December of that year.
It seems to be an extraordinary mess, first of all. Remarkable how all these things came together to set up this situation. And again, I suppose it underscores the basic point that what happened here, this tragedy, yes, and happened in South Dakota, that's where the shots were fired. But that to look for the explanation for the setup, you have to look a very long way away, really. You have to look to Washington, D.C.
Yes, David, I think that's right. And I think that this was, for me, the hardest book I've ever written, because so many of the things that led to what is unquestionably a horrific massacre, these were women and children and ill men who were largely unarmed, who were gunned down, and a number of soldiers went down with them because of the crossfire. There is nobody who does not deplore that massacre. And yet the steps to it were so quotidian, if you will, little tiny decisions people made that seemed to make sense in their larger context, in this larger idea that if we don't keep hold of the Congress, if we don't keep hold of the White House, America is ruined. And the steps as it led to this massacre, you know, I would sit every day trying to write, and I actually took a couple months off of the writing of this book because every day there was another little decision made And I knew where it was going to go, and they didn't, and I couldn't stop it from happening. And that was just, a huge wake-up call about the little decisions that seem to make sense in the larger political context that do, in fact, have horrific outcomes that we really can't divorce ourselves from, although it's much easier to say, oh, I didn't do that. In fact, those are all the outcomes of the decisions that made sense in a political, national context. That have these kind of outcomes.
Just again to talk some more about what life was like for the Sioux. It was certainly very bad. They were losing what land they had. They were being pressed into being farmers, which certainly wasn't part of their tradition. And on top of that, this really wasn't great land for farming anyway. It was not a good time to be trying to raise food on the land. They were given little to no help by the government. Government hadn't made the promises, hadn't fulfilled their promises. And so, as you say, that out of this kind of desperation was born this religious movement, the Ghost Dance. And the belief was that would restore, it was a sort of a mystical kind of approach. The belief was it would restore to the world the way it had been before the white people came. And I think that some, in fact, really even believed that one of the things that would happen was the white people would just disappear.
Right.
But it also, at the same time, you have to make the point, as you did, that this was not a militant movement. In fact, nonviolence was a very important feature of this movement. And yet, why was it that the Indian agents on the ground there in South Dakota and the government in Washington, D.C., thought that this was indeed a dangerous movement and that what the native people were preparing to do was to make war on the whites?
Well, one of the things that's very interesting about the Ghost Dance, and everything you've said about it is true, one of the things that's very interesting about it is that although, again, a third of the U.S. Army mobilizes against the Ghost Dancers in South Dakota, the Ghost Dance is not unique to South Dakota. In fact, the Ghost Dance starts in Nevada and burns across the plains. The Indians across, all up and down the plains, are dancing the Ghost Dance. But the Army only goes into South Dakota, which itself is, to me, very suspect right there. It does seem to have made a great deal of sense to me for these people to have looked for an alternative to a real-world solution to their terrible problems, to have looked for a religious answer, for a new world in the future rather than looking at the present. But one of the things that I found out and that I think is, again, very significant is the Army, the people who actually knew the Sioux and had worked with them or against them since the 1870s and sometimes even before, from the 1860s, when, in fact, America was embroiled in a big war with the Sioux, the Sioux Wars that many people don't know about. The Army men who knew these guys said repeatedly to Washington, there is not a problem. There is not an uprising. These people are not going to war. They are starving. And what you need to do is you need to give them food and fulfill your promises to them, and then they'll stop dancing. The problem is that their families are dying, they're starving. They actually there's actually a terrible version of the flu that crosses the world, not just America and Europe, but the world in 1889 to 1890, and they're dying like from that as well, and that of course made them susceptible to other things as well. Once you take away the starvation and make it possible for them to survive in some fashion, then all of this will go away, to which the government responded a couple of things. First of all, they insisted that the West was a terrific place to farm. They insisted that in public, but their private papers suggested they knew how bad things were. Because, in fact, a lot of people in Oklahoma were starving in 1890, and the government actually very quietly sends the Army out to try and help the people starving to death in Oklahoma. So they know things are bad out there, but publicly they maintain that the West is a terrific place to be, that anybody who's willing to work hard can, in fact, grow food in the West, and it's just that the Indians are lazy and won't do it. Well, of course, that puts the Indians in a terrible position, because on the one hand, they're supposed to be farming, and it's so dry, even the hay crop dies in 1890. That's the wild grasses that are meant to grow on the prairies. It's very hard for them to even imagine being able to farm anything. But second of all, as you say, they're supposed to get supplies from the government. That's part of the treaties that were signed in 1868 and then in 1889. They're supposed to get supplies to enable them to farm because, farming takes, as you know in Illinois, farming takes an awful lot of money. You need to have equipment. You need to have animals. Animals are hard to keep, and they're expensive. You have to have veterinary care. You have to have seeds. You have to have the farm animals that you're going to live off. It's a fairly expensive proposition. Well, what happened was that Congress always funded the treaties. So congressmen would say, hey, what's the problem here? We funded these treaties. But then the way the money was supposed to be dispersed is that it went to one man, an Indian agent, who was chosen during the Harris administration by the senators of his state. It would go to one man, and his job was to contract out all of the money that Congress had appropriated for the Indians to build hospitals, to build schools, sometimes to build houses, to buy seeds, to buy equipment, to hire talented farmers, to teach the Indians how to farm. He was supposed to do all that, but realistically, he had no oversight at all, and invariably, he simply used that money as a political war chest. So the Congress would appropriate the money. The Indians would never see any of it. Meanwhile, back east, the politicians would say, well, they'd farm if they weren't lazy. The problem is they're lazy and they're savage. So the Indians are really caught between a rock and a hard place. And, you know, again, writing this, I got to know a lot of them. I read everything you possibly could read on people who had known them or things they had said, because they often traveled back to Washington to say, we can't live this way. So I read all that and got to know some of them, and you looked at their lives and thought they really had no options. It's not like they could pick up and go back and live with the wife's folks the way that people in Kansas did during 1890. They couldn't leave. They couldn't farm because of the heat, because they didn't have any equipment. They could no longer hunt because they'd lost all their land, and they needed permission to leave the reservation from their agents who wouldn't give it. They really were slowly being starved to death and having their culture completely stripped from them. And they were good, smart, you know, people, regular people, just like everybody else, that were being crunched and had really no options but another world. And it's not hard to see why they thought that way, why they decided that dancing and talking to the ghost dance enabled them to talk to their ancestors who had died and their relatives who had died, which, again, is very comforting for people who had had an enormously high death rate in the last 2 years, to actually see their wives after they had passed on, or their children, and to hear from them that, in fact, there was a great world coming where the whites would go away. Pretty obvious why that happened, and quite reasonable, I think, for that to have happened under those situations.
Our guest is Heather Cox Richardson. She's professor of history at University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and the book we're talking about, her most recent, is titled Wounded Knee, Party Politics and the Road to an American Massacre. It's published by Basic Books, and it is indeed about the Wounded Knee Massacre. It took place in December of 1890, and as we explained in the beginning, the research that led to this book really began with a student in a class asking a question, asking her, well, why did this happen? And she said, actually, she didn't have a ready answer. So she started to do the research and started to look at the many ways in which the massacre that took place in South Dakota, 1890, was very much rooted in the politics of the country at the time. And the result, as she explained, a lot of what maybe seemed to be small decisions, small things that happened, but that set up the conditions that eventually led to the massacre. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and will-talk@illinois.edu if you'd like to send an email. You could understand why, if in Washington they were interested, the party in control in Washington, the Republican Party, was interested in getting Republican votes in South Dakota, that they would have a tough Indian policy, or what would be presumed to be perceived as a tough Indian policy. Was that in national politics? I mean, people elsewhere, people who lived in Philadelphia or Maine or wherever. Was what the government was doing in regards to Native peoples in South Dakota, was that an issue?
It was. Where this all comes from is during the Civil War, the Republican Party is really formed right before the Civil War, as you know, and it is formed to fight slavery for the most part. And the Republican Party works out during the Civil War what it really believes in and what it really stands for. And what it believes in and what it stands for coming out of the 1860s is hard work, economic prosperity, and the development of the West. So that's the bottom line among the rest of the Republican administrations, which by the Harrison is really the bottom of the barrel. You know, there's a lot of good Republican administrations in there, too, but Harrison is really the absolute bottom of the barrel. But there is in literature in America in the 1860s through 1900 this idea that economic growth and hard work is what America is all about. And by the time you get to Harrison, they have decided that what that really means is big business, which is really not what Lincoln was up to, but they've decided it's really about big business. So anybody who sticks with the Republicans believes that, in fact, anybody who works hard can make it. And whether you're in Maine as a fisherman or whether you're lumbering in North Carolina or lumbering in Minnesota, for that matter, you believe that anybody who works hard should be able to survive. And they look at things like the African Americans in the South, who some of whom are making it and doing very well. There's a man an African American man in Montana who's worth over $4 million by 1890, and he made his money in mining. They look at this and they say, look, people can make it in America. The Indians just have to work. That's the real problem. They just have to work. Now, the Democrats, on the other hand, have not a hugely dissimilar background than the Republicans, except that they say, wait a minute, the government can't simply promote business. Because if you simply promote business, what you do is you allow it to have terrible working conditions. You allow it to pollute the country. You know, at this point, there are no regulations about what goes into food. In fact, they're painting candy for little kids. By the 1890s, they actually use poisonous paints on the candy that they paint for little kids. There's no government regulation of that. There's no regulation of food. There's no regulation of what can be dumped anywhere. So we get cesspools of poisonous chemicals all through the cities and around where people are living. They look at that and they say, the government can't simply promote business. What the government is supposed to do is to make it possible for anyone to survive in America and to make it in America. And that being the case, the government has to actually behave in a way that's good for everybody. It has to regulate business. It has to be smart about the way it develops the West. And it has to be honest with people like the Sioux and with people like the African Americans in the South and with the Sicilians in Louisiana and with the Chinese in California. It needs actually to treat everybody equally and respectfully in order to make sure that as many people as possible can make it in America. So when the trouble starts on the reservations, the way it plays out in the newspapers is completely determined by party affiliation, because newspapers belong to a party in the 19th century. They're either Republican or Democrat, or by the 1890s, there's a significant number of independent newspapers as well that don't claim a party affiliation. The Republican newspapers say from the beginning, in the summer of 1890, they say, well, there might be some troubles on the reservations, but it has nothing to do with the fact we took the Indians' land. The real problem on the reservations is that the Democrats screwed it up when they were out here, and they let the Indians have their way too much. So we're going to impose order on them. We're going to cut down their food. We're going to make it so they'll starve unless they farm. We're going to take control over this. The Democrats, on the other hand, say, now hold on just a minute. The problem is not the Democrats, and the problem is not the Indians. The problem is that you've got terrible agents in there who are not giving them enough food. This is all about the fact your administration is so corrupt that it's using all government money simply in order to get reelected. You need to actually use that money for what it was intended for, which is to feed the Indians and give them enough that they can survive on their own. So there becomes this partisan split. As soon as that happens, the Republicans realize that they've got a problem, because it's pretty well known that they are unbelievably corrupt. It's sort of by 1890, the spring of 1890, everybody knows this is a really corrupt administration. Even moderate Republicans have turned against it. They start to say, oh, it's not that we're corrupt. The problem out here is not that we're mishandling the Indians. The problem is that they're savages. And the Republicans increasingly start to say, well, our problem is not that we're mishandling them. They're just so savage they can't be controlled. Now, this is a really problematic way to talk about what's happening in South Dakota, because, of course, there are no lives lost. The Sioux don't kill anybody. They don't take any property. They're not threatening anybody. When they have their religious movements, their religious dances, they let whites come watch. So it's clear that they're really not very hostile. So what happens at that point is the Republicans fall back on old Indian enemies, most notably Sitting Bull. Sitting Bull had led the Sioux. He is the leader of one of the Sioux bands, and he had led the Sioux since about 1875 in their war against the American Army. Now, in fact, he had actually not led the troops in the Battle of the Little Bighorn because he was ill that day, but he was sort of the leader, although not the one on the field that day. He was the head of everybody that day, although he wasn't on the field. After that, he still leads the Sioux, who are hostile to the army, and eventually ends up taking them to Canada when gradually the rest of the Sioux surrender to the army, including his right-hand man, Crazy Horse, who is then stabbed when he surrenders and is killed, stabbed in the kidneys and is killed in 1877. Sitting Bull goes to Canada, but then he comes back, and by 1881 he is surrendered to the U.S. Army, and by 1883 he's living on a reservation. Now, this is an old man by now. He is old. He is living in a log cabin on the Grand River in South Dakota. He does not have a large following because people sort of realize his day is over. And he is not a ghost dancer. He is, in fact, he hates his agent. He doesn't like the U.S. Army, and he's not keen on the U.S. government. But he is also not a ghost dancer. He is just living on the reservation, trying to retain what authority he had before that. So the Republican papers start to say that really the problem is that Sitting Bull is on the warpath again. Well, he wasn't. He simply wasn't. And anybody who knew him and knew the situation in South Dakota knew this was crazy. He was an old man. He was living, as I say, in his cabin with his wives and children, and he was not part of any of the ghost dancing. He wanted to be, but he simply couldn't force himself to believe in the religion. So in the Republican papers, Sitting Bull becomes evil. He becomes the leader of this movement where all these Indians, the Sioux, and they call up images of the Battle of the Little Bighorn and of the Red Clouds War from 1866 to 1868, and say that these warriors are going back on the warpath and they're going to come destroy settlers. And that becomes the story in the Republican newspapers. The Democrats, on the other hand, say this is nuts. This is absolutely not the case. And they are helped by the fact the army men who are out there living in the forts and who know the Indians agree with the Democrats. They say there's not an uprising. Sitting Bull's an old man. Red Cloud, who also occasionally shows up in Republican newspapers as being very dangerous, he is blind. He's in his 70s and he's blind. He's not leading anybody anywhere. And they say there's just no way that we're facing this huge uprising. But the Republicans insist, in fact, that they are. And they're helped, of course, by the mass entertainment of the day, which is Buffalo Bill's Wild West Show, which always has brutal killer Indians and good cowboys and good army men. So that's sort of in the American consciousness. So this story, the Republican story of what's happening in South Dakota, fits. Interestingly enough, until the troops go into South Dakota, there is not a newspaper editorial worrying from South Dakota. There's not a letter of panic from any South Dakota settler. The governor of South Dakota doesn't say there's any problem at all. There's no sign that anybody in South Dakota is worried about anything, any white person in South Dakota, that is, or black settlers. South Dakota has a vibrant black population as well. They're not worried at all. The people who are in real trouble in South Dakota are the Indians, and there's a lot of information about that before the troops go in, but none from the other side of the coin. But that's not the way it plays out in national media.
Our guest again is Heather Cox Richardson. She's an historian. She teaches at University of Massachusetts Amherst, and we're talking about what you will find in her new book. It's titled Wounded Knee, Party Politics and the Road to an American Massacre, and it's published by Basic Books. And we are now coming into about our last 15 minutes or so, and questions are welcome. We have somebody, a couple of people here. We'll get them in, starting with a caller in Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. You haven't mentioned anything about the mineral wealth in South Dakota, mainly the Black Hills gold, that I'm sure had to have some influence on this, because those people they wanted that gold and they were going to get it under any circumstances, and the Black Hills were very, very important to the Sioux and the Lakota. Did you have anything to say about that?
Yes, and you're absolutely right. The Black Hills are vitally important. They're actually already lost by the time of Wounded Knee. They're lost right after the Battle of the Little Bighorn. But it's not just the Black Hills that are important for their gold. There's also tin in the Black Hills, and that's one of the reasons that the Republicans want South Dakota so badly, is they want the tin mines because they're supported by the tin manufacturers in the country. And tin is very, very valuable in the 1890s because people carry their lunches in tin pails. They milk their cows into tin pails. They use tin dishes. And they're starting to use tin cans. So tin is very, very valuable. And that really pushes what happens in taking the land and making South Dakota a state in 1890. But not only are the Black Hills are important religiously to the Sioux, that whole region, the Black Hills, but also the Powder River country, which stretches on the other side of the Black Hills all the way up into Montana, to this day remains some of the best hunting in the country. It's phenomenal hunting land. And that's really what the Sioux, especially under Sitting Bull, are trying to hold on to, are the Black Hills and the Powder River country. If they can hold on to Powder River, then they can survive forever. And they really believe that that's really the key to their existence. Now, during the Civil War, when John Bozeman blazes the Bozeman Trail up to the gold mines in Montana, he blazes the Bozeman Trail right through the Powder River country. The Army becomes determined to protect that Bozeman Trail, even though it is entirely Sioux land and it is not disputed that it's Sioux land. They decide to protect that. They put in a number of forts, and that's what starts the Sioux Wars in 1866 through 1868, and then finally into 1877 and as far as 1890, is that desperate need to protect the Powder River country. In the process of protecting that, of course, we get the Battle of the Little Bighorn in 1876, and after the Battle of the Little Bighorn, a number of the leaders of the Sioux are forced to give up the Black Hills completely against their will and completely against the terms of the 1868 treaty, which said that three-quarters of the Sioux men had to agree to part with any more land. The government throws that out the window, and it says to the leaders of the Sioux, sign the stupid treaty, give us the Black Hills, or we will never give you any more food again, and you'll all starve to death. And that's how they lose it. And it is truly a loss. One of the points that I make in the book is that it is one of the huge ironies of this whole story that, in fact, when they put Mount Rushmore into the Black Hills, it's an effort to bring tourists to South Dakota because, of course, the great number of settlers that the Republicans foresaw never materialized. So South Dakota, by the early 20th century, was desperately poor, and they wanted to bring in money. So they put Mount Rushmore in the Black Hills, and the sculptor who designs it says that the reason he wants it there and what it's supposed to symbolize is that, and this is a quote, man has a right to be free and to be happy, which to me is the ultimate irony to have taken that land, the sacred land, against the terms of the treaty, and then to carve a statue in it that's supposed to symbolize freedom and happiness just seems to me to be the ultimate irony.
Yeah, could I bring in one other point?
Yep.
I was wondering, you were talking about the corruption of the Harrison administration. Wasn't this during the Teapot Dome period, too? Or did that come after that?
Hello, sorry about that.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Did you hear the question of the caller?
I did not.
You want to go ahead and repeat it?
Yes. I was asking, since you were talking about the corruption of the Harrison administration, didn't the Teapot Dome take place during that general period of time also?
It did indeed.
And it was a horribly corrupt situation.
Yes, they really, and again, the backstory to that and to the whole administration was that they were enormously corrupt. They had a huge war chest, and they used it, well, to the point that even their own men said, you know, we're going to go to jail if we don't cut this out. But they did it not because they were, thought of themselves as criminals, but because, in fact, they believed that if they did not keep Republicans in power, and the only way to keep them in power was to keep the money coming in so they could keep on, you know, buying voters and stacking the deck, if they did not do that, the country would be destroyed. They firmly believed that. In fact, the man chiefly responsible for dispersing that money, that the corrupt money out of the Republican war chest, was John Wanamaker, who was a devout Christian. who spent a great deal of his money on missions and who was always preaching and ran a church. And Harrison himself was a very religious man. But they really believed that if they didn't keep this system going with the government supporting big business and supporting economic development, that America, as the great hope of the world, was going to end and that they had to do it. They had a moral duty really to corrupt the system, which is, again, one of the huge ironies of the whole story.
All right. I want to thank the caller. We have several others. In fact, the lines are full, and we have just about 10 minutes left, so I want to get some other folks here. We'll go next to Champaign County. Line one. Hello.
Hi. Interesting about the advertisements that it's good farming land, but what was the population in this area about then, and what about how many were buying farms and how many were on the homestead where you work the land? What does that mean for 5 years and then you get it without actually paying very much for it? Okay, thanks.
Well, that was the idea, was that people would go out and homestead. But in fact, it doesn't happen in the 1890s because the drought's so bad, everyone's going the other direction. In fact, Dakota, it's known as Dakota because it's Dakota Territory before it splits into North and South Dakota. Dakota has a huge boom from 1878 after the Battle of the Little Bighorn, which is actually in Montana, but it helps to push the Sioux west. From 1878 to about 1884 is when Dakota booms. Then there's the drought starts in 1884, 1885, and in fact, then it's very hard for the Dakota to grow. And one of the things that Republicans are worried about a lot in 1890, and in fact, L. Frank Baum, who wrote The Wizard of Oz a little bit later than this, is living in South Dakota, and he's beside himself about the fact that a lot of South Dakotans decide in 1890 that they're going to move to Tennessee. And he's desperate to make sure they don't do that because, of course, that's going to hurt business, so you need to keep people there. So South Dakota booms, Dakota Territory, but our part of it, what becomes South Dakota, booms from 1878 to 1884. It's known as the Great Dakota Boom, and then it just simply falls apart after the drought starts in 1884, 1885.
All right. To Urbana next, line two. Hello.
Hello. You're quite right that the practices and trends of the Teapot Dome era and the 1890s were very close. But, in fact, Teapot Dome occurred during the Harding administration, which was in the 1920s.
Yes, you're right.
In fact, Harding was probably the only real rival for the world's worst president until very recent times.
Well, you've caught me because actually I'm writing a book on the whole Republican Party, and I do tend to confuse Harding and Harrison because they're not that far apart, and there are an awful lot of parallels.
You're absolutely right.
All right. Well, thank you.
I certainly look forward to reading your book. Thank you.
Let us go on. And this is another Urbana caller, line three. Hello.
Hi. Yeah. My question is about the battle itself. The Wounded Knee, if it had been a battle, not all these women and children and old people would have been killed, massacred. And so it seems like there must be something related to the commander of the military unit on that day, or there must be some military explanation as to why it went from a what should have been a minor battle because the people really couldn't defend themselves and instead turned out to be a massacre, got triggered into a massacre. So could you discuss that a little bit?
Yeah. In fact, I'm really pleased that the caller raised the question because here we're coming to about our last 5 minutes or so. And one of the things that we really haven't actually talked very much about what happened or how it happened, and particularly how it is that, you know, we talked about the fact that the Indians were, they were hungry, some of them were sick. They included women and children. They were certainly overmatched in terms of the arms that the army had. And this was not, there was, even if they decided that they were going to fight, it wouldn't have been much of a fight. It was just something that didn't need to happen.
Well, I have to say, your caller there is a historian, there's no doubt, because that's exactly the sort of question that you have to ask and say, what really happened here? As I said before, the Army brass was dead set against the Army going into South Dakota. They kept saying, if you send us in, you're going to create a problem. We don't want to be there, except in the capacity they already were there. This is a political problem. You need to feed these guys. Leave us out of it. Well, the agents I talked about who went in and who were not good were panicked. One of them was quite actually possibly a drug addict by then. He certainly was shortly thereafter, and his letters are very troubled. He started, from the minute he got there, from less than a week after he got to South Dakota, he started to say, the Indians are going to massacre us. They're going to kill us all. We desperately need troops. Back in east, in Washington, in fact, the Army kept saying, we don't want to go in. This is crazy. There isn't a problem. But the politicians end up backing their guy, the agent. And what they do is they say to the head of the Army, and he's actually he's the third in command at this point, but he is in control of what's known as the Division of the Missouri, which covers the plains. They say to him, okay, there may not be a problem, but if there isn't, it's on your head. So why don't you decide if you think you should go in or not? Well, this puts him in a really bad position, because if he doesn't take the troops in and there's a massacre, he's in trouble. And if he does take the troops in and there's a problem, he's in trouble. So it's a lose-lose for him, and this is a big deal because he wants to be president. He's got a really good shot at being president next time around, and Harrison's terrified of him. This is Nelson Miles. He sends the troops in. He wants to take a very few of them in and get out as soon as he possibly can. Get the ghost dancers to stop dancing and get out before there's a problem. The Harris administration says to him, forget it. Why don't you stay till spring? You know, South Dakota likes the Army. We'll bring in a lot of money. Why don't you guys stay till spring? And while we're at it, we'll send in a third of the U.S. Army. So Nelson Miles is in a terrible situation. He brings the Army in, but he says to him, steer clear of the Indians. They're already frightened of us. We're here to keep the peace. We're not here to have a battle. The situation escalates. I know we don't have a lot of time. It escalates for about 6 weeks until, in the process of arresting Sitting Bull, he simply wants to pull him away and make it look like he's in control of the situation, Miles does. In the process of arresting Sitting Bull, the Indian police on Sitting Bull's reservation, there's a personal feud involved, they actually murder Sitting Bull. When that happens, Sitting Bull's people run south. They're trying to run down to take shelter with an Indian leader they think can protect them. They start to run south, and that group of people who have not been involved in any way with the Army, and if not really, they're just running at that point, they're the ones who get caught by the Army, who are supposed to be rounding them up. That group, led by a man named Bigfoot, they're the ones, a group of Minneconjus, who get caught at Wounded Knee Creek. They are perfectly happy to surrender to the Army. They're actually on good terms with the Army, as far as they're concerned, and the Army and they are moving in the same direction, which is a great thing because Bigfoot has pneumonia, and he's very ill, and he can travel in an Army ambulance if they travel with him. He's perfectly happy to be with them. They settle down on the night of December 28th, but when that happens, the Army guys who were in charge of capturing them get nervous and they call for reinforcements. When they do that, the man who takes over command, who's in charge of the 7th Cavalry, which makes him the highest-ranking man on the field, is a guy named James Forsyth, who has only been on desk jobs really since the Civil War. He ignores Nelson Miles' order to keep the Indians and the soldiers separate. He intends to overawe the Indians on the morning of December 29th, prove to them how powerful he is, and he sets up his men in a circle around the Indians. In the process of disarming the Indians, the firing starts. It's a struggle over a gun, and a gun goes off into the air. In the process of disarming them, the gun goes off. And Forsyth screams, fire, fire on them. We have that now because of some new accounts that have just been published. When that happens, the soldiers, who many of whom are new recruits, lower their guns and fire at the Indians in front of them, but of course they also take out their own soldiers on the other side. The Indians then dive for the guns that the soldiers have. They stab some soldiers, take some guns, and fight their way back into a ditch that runs behind where their teepees had been, and the firing goes on for about an hour. The soldiers at that point have artillery on a hill. They take out the women and children with the artillery, and then they move the artillery to take out all the men they can get out of the ravine. And it takes a couple of hours, and they chase down everybody they can find and kill about 270 of the Indians and about 25 soldiers.
And this, do you think that's a good figure? And I guess I ask the question because it seems that the numbers of those who were killed seem to vary quite a lot depending on what sort of source you look at.
I've actually got a fairly long footnote on that. The problem with doing numbers when you do Indian history is that everything is an estimate and every side has an interest in exaggerating things.
Yeah.
Where I came up with that number is that the Army did a very careful count of how many people were traveling with Bigfoot when he surrendered the night before. So we have the number of people there. It was about 300. And then we know that there were people who lived. We know that there are a certain number of people who lived from the massacre, and we also know that a number of bodies were taken away the night before. So we have two sets of numbers from the people who threw the bodies into a grave. So going through all those numbers, I came up with about 270, but it could be anywhere from 250 to 300. I don't think we can go higher than 300 or lower than 250.
Yeah, we're here at the point we have to finish, and maybe I have about a minute. Unfair to ask such a question, but hearing this story and reading it through, you just have to wonder, did it have to go this way? And not just talking about did Wounded Knee have to go this way, but did American relations with the Native peoples have to go this way?
Certainly not in the 1890s. Certainly not in the 1890s. It did not have to go that way. I think what we really need to do is look at the full impacts of the political decisions we make and their repercussions. Had people done that, somebody asked me this very question, this would not have happened under Grover Cleveland because he understood the implications of the things he did in a way that Harrison did not. And he also understood that if the Democrats lost the House, it was not going to be the end of the world in a way that Harrison couldn't see.
Well, at that, we will have to stop. The story in a more complete way than we've done here is told in the book Wounded Knee, Party Politics and the Road to an American Massacre. It's published by Basic Books, just out recently. The author, our guest, Heather Cox Richardson. She is professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Professor Richardson, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.